Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 3rd of March. We do want to thank all of you who contributed to Wisconsin Public Radio during our winter membership drive and tell you the results. In case you haven't heard them, you donated over $873,000 to help Wisconsin Public Radio, your WPR station, and also the wonderful programming that you depend on. We had more than 6,900 members pledging, and very pleased to welcome 1,875 new members to the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. So we thank you very much. Matt Kibbe is our guest this hour. He is president and CEO of Freedom Works and has been much in the news the last few days because of the Conservative Political Action Conference, which met in Washington last weekend. There was a lot of talk about what road the Republicans are taking, what road, according to this conference, the Democrats have been taking. There was a straw poll that was taken. There's been a lot of press about whether or not Rush Limbaugh is the head of the Republican Party and a great deal of discussion about taxes, et cetera. Our guest this hour wrote in a recent piece, President Obama has mentioned his fondness for FDR. Let's hope he soon comes to prefer Warren Harding. We'll talk about that during the course of this hour. Matt has been with Freedom Works for a number of years. It was previously known as Citizens for a Sound Economy. He's an economist by training, and his career has spanned the works of academia, business, and lawmaking. He was chief of staff and House Budget Committee associate for U.S. Representative Dan Miller, Republican from Florida. He was also a senior economist for the Republican National Committee during Lee Atwater's tenure as chairman and managing editor of Market Process, which is an economics journal published by the Center for the Study of Market Processes at George Mason University. We'll be welcoming for phone calls for Matt Kibbe. Freedom Works is an organization that believes individual liberty and the freedom to compete increases consumer choices and provides individuals with the greatest control over what they own and earn. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email if you'd like. That address is talk@wpr.org. Hi, Matt. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. So tell me, what were the highlights of the conference, the Conservative Political Action Conference? What solid things did you hear that you applauded other than yourself, because I know you were a speaker? And what did people walk away with that they were proud of?
You know, I think the thing that, and I have to admit, I didn't see every speech there by any means, but I saw a number of the Republican leaders talking about returning to fiscal responsibility. And this is a problem that has plagued both Republicans and Democrats. Just there's been too much spending, too much irresponsible spending. And I think there was a lot of soul searching at this event as to how Republicans, at least, and conservatives and libertarians and everyone else that might fit into the right of center category can get their footing again on the whole issue.
Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? What is fiscal responsibility, Matt?
Well, you know, that's a good question, because President Obama certainly talks about fiscal responsibility. Democrats in Congress talk about fiscal responsibility, and then groups like Freedom Works talk about fiscal responsibility. And I think generally speaking, we could all agree that it means living within our means from the government's point of view. You shouldn't spend money that you don't have, and ultimately you have to balance your budget, and you need to watch the debt that we heap on to our children and grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. There was a lot of talk, as you know, because you were there, and actually you led one of the conference sessions on whether or not this new administration could be described as taking a socialist path. Do you think they are? Do you worry about a socialist trend with the Obama administration?
Well, I'm a trained economist, and I'll throw out the definition of socialism, because I know it's a loaded word, because it has a lot of history. But the definition of socialism from an economist's point of view is government ownership of the means of production. And what has happened recently, and this did not start with Obama, it started with President Bush, but the government, for instance, has taken ownership stakes, preferred stock in banks, as part of the TARP bailout, President Obama has continued that trend, and he's talking about, there's talk of nationalizing the banks, and there's talk of nationalizing the healthcare system. And to me, this means government systems, which is socialist. So it's not the pejorative. I mean, I think it's a pejorative because I think those are bad systems, but it's not just a name you throw at something. It's a definition of what's actually being proposed. And I think we need to understand that whatever, if you're liberal or conservative, you need to understand that government run systems don't necessarily run that efficiently. They run differently. And there are certain things that the government should do, but generally speaking, you don't want them to get involved in too many things because they just won't do a good job doing it.
Hmm. I know you wrote a recent piece about Warren Harding and FDR. There are many who say that FDR, as you well know, was one of our better presidents because he did get a lot of government programs to run extremely efficiently, gave people jobs, established parks and theater companies, and put a lot of people back to work building infrastructure. What was wrong with that?
Well, the first thing that was wrong with it is, you'll get disagreements on this, but the Great Depression lasted a long time, and that the first question you would ask if these programs worked so well, why did the economy literally sit in horrible unemployment, shrinking productivity all the way up until World War II? So he has a popularity which I'm at least a little baffled by, because just as an economic manager, the results simply weren't there.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
I'll add one thing on that. There's a question of, and Obama is trying to do the same thing, and President Bush tried to do the same thing, this idea that you can spend your way out of a recession, and this is of course, Keynesian Economics 101.
Mm-hmm.
The question you always have to ask is, government doesn't have any money unless it gets it from somewhere. And it can either raise taxes to get more money, it can borrow the money, which eventually somebody has to pay back, or more and more you're seeing it will actually expand the money supply, inflate the currency. All of these have negative consequences on the economy, so you might get a short-term bump under the Keynesian model, but you have bills to pay, and those come back, and they dampen economic activity, and they disincentivize the very entrepreneurs that typically bring us out of these problem economies.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start with part of the budget bill here from last week, and that's to raise taxes on the upper 5% of income earners in America. What do you think of that idea? Will that create problems for us, do you think?
I think it will. And there's a lot of popular sentiment for raising taxes on the rich right now. And this is something we've tried before. We tried it in 1990. We had a very weak economy. We were in a recession. We had a budget deficit. And you'll remember part of what they did was they raised taxes on upper income earners.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with doing that is most small businesses fall into this category because they're individually owned companies. They're not corporations, and by definition, most small businesses certainly bring in. I think the cutoff for the Obama tax increase is $167,000 a year. So you're not talking about necessarily multimillionaires. You're talking about people that are running small businesses and are going to get hit by this tax increase. And that's the power of the economy, comes from the bottom. The small guy is not necessarily the multinational corporations that we're bailing out today.
And yet when you compare that, people will say, with what happened with the Bush administration and the philosophy of not cutting those taxes, of giving breaks to that group of people, that didn't seem to work either. So what's going to work?
Well, the story of how we get into this mess is pretty complicated, and there were a lot of mistakes that were made. One of the interesting mythologies about the Bush tax cuts is that they're permanent, and they were temporary tax cuts. And I, as an economist, I always worry when any fiscal policy creates uncertainty. You want to know what the cost of capital is. You want to know how much you're going to pay in taxes. And if you're going into a 20-year investment venture, you just want to know what the rules of the game are. And I think one of the mistakes that Bush made, and there's reasons that this mistake was made, but these things were temporarily phased in, and they're phased out. And one of the things Obama is doing to show more revenue is simply letting these expire.
Mm-hmm.
But if whether or not you believe in higher taxes or lower taxes, most businessmen, their first cry is for give us some certainty so we know what the rules of the game are as we try to create jobs.
Yeah. At this point, people just want to figure out a way to stabilize the economy to make sure they have their jobs and are not losing their jobs or losing some of the days of the week they have to work. What's the answer for that? Did you come away after the Conservative Political Action Conference with a plan, with some alternatives to what we are doing now?
Well, you mentioned I wrote a piece comparing the Harding administration and FDR, and I really think that the best thing the government can do, and it does things that we all understand, like it pays unemployment benefits and certainly entitlements, particularly Medicaid balloon when people are out of work, and we do that. But what we're doing today is fundamentally different from that. We're getting involved in a lot of economic decisions, and I really think up until FDR the philosophy, or I should say Hoover, not FDR, but up until then, the philosophy was that the first goal of government fiscal policy was to live within its means, balance the budget, and not get heavily involved in the regulation and the subsidization of the economy. And you got to let these small businessmen, these entrepreneurs, these guys with the energy and the good ideas and the incentive to do well, they're the guys that are going to fix our problems. They're going to create the new jobs. That's where they come from. And for every job, quote unquote, that the government is creating under these various spending packages, that money comes out of someone else's pocket. So, and probably an entrepreneur that could have created more jobs.
We're going to take phone calls from Matt, and we'll do so in just a moment. Matt Gibbe is our guest. He is president and CEO of Freedom Works, and he was one of the speakers at the Conservative Political Action Conference, which met in Washington last weekend. And we're talking about a number of issues. I guess the main issue is there a different way? And if so, what is the way to making sure that we're doing well economically in the United States? What do we think of the Obama administration's budget plan, his plan for rescuing banks and the auto industry, et cetera? Is there another way to go? And will the Republicans offer a clear plan in terms of opposition? Will they become an opposition that is offering alternatives? We're welcoming your phone calls. The number, we have one line open, so I think you ought to just get it. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Or send an email if you'd like. That address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Matt, and let's start with Louie from Waukesha. Hey, Louie, how are you?
Fine.
Good.
Regarding the government's inability to handle something without screwing it up, what is your evaluation of its handling Social Security and Medicare?
Well, there's two ways to look at it. We'll take Social Security. Social Security is the easier story. The checks go out on time, and from that point of view, it is run terribly efficiently. The problem with Social Security is that it is wildly underfunded, and at some point, we will not have enough revenues to actually pay those checks. And there's been a long tradition in the budget, actually ever since Johnson unified the federal budget, of taking money out of the so-called Social Security Trust Fund and spending it on general programs. And now the opposite demographics are happening, so we have less people paying into the system and more people taking out. Well, we can't go back and get that money because they already spent it. And the problem is that the money simply won't be there. So between Social Security and Medicare, these programs are wildly underfunded and are simply going to collapse someday or consume the entire federal budget.
So what do we do with them?
I think our view, not surprising, is that you have to give people personal responsibility and ownership for their retirement. Our preferred solution is to, on the Social Security side, is to take the huge amount of money that we all pay in payroll taxes, and keep in mind that people pay payroll taxes on the very first dollar they earn.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very regressive tax. And let them put that into an account that they can own and control. And if they're risk averse, they can hold it in bonds and very safe things. If they want to bet on the stock market, they can choose a diversified portfolio and do that. And obviously the reaction right now is everybody just lost 30-40% in their 401ks.
Right.
But keep in mind that the government, again, they don't have this money unless they get it from somebody. So when the economy goes down, the fate of Social Security and Medicare go down, we're all in the same boat. And I, for one, would like to know that I'm responsible for planning for my own retirement, for making my own health care decisions. And that's a big philosophical difference with how the current entitlements are run.
And yet the counter, as you well know, to that would be if you would have lost a whole bunch of your accounting on Social Security and you had invested in the stock market because it was doing well not that long ago, you would have lost almost everything. You would have been out on the street, wouldn't you?
Well, you wouldn't have been on the street. Well, it depends, because an investment strategy, a prudent investment strategy for any individual is to take more risks when you're younger, and you're accumulating wealth over a lifetime on the assumption that the stock market is absolutely going to be going down at certain points. And at some point, as you approach retirement age, you get out of the stock market altogether. You put it in an annuity. You put it into something that's safe. So if you were 65 and betting everything in the stock market, that's no advisor would tell you to do that, and it's just not something you should be doing.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call, Louie. Let's go next to Pat from Richland Center. Hi, Pat.
Yes, good morning. Let's just talk about healthcare for 1 minute here. The healthcare system in America right now is capitalized, meaning it puts money first. And the healthcare system that's socialized puts people first. And I guess is what I'd like the guest to answer is which healthcare system does he think most Americans would prefer? One that puts money first or one that puts people first?
I think Americans want a healthcare system that puts people first. You wouldn't be surprised to know I have a different perspective on what that means. Right now, the healthcare system is corrupted by so-called third-party payers. Typically, your business, or in a growing percentage of cases, the government is making decisions for you about which treatments are appropriate and what the reimbursements for those treatments are going to be. I want to live in a world where myself and my doctor make those decisions. And, you know, with those decisions comes a cost, because healthcare will never be free. Right now, you have a third party paying for it, so you overuse it. But in exchange for that, you don't get choices about which procedures you think are best for you. Under a socialized system, you take that model to the extreme. You don't pay for anything, but you also don't get to choose what's available to you. And the problem in socialized systems has always been ration care. You have free good, so demand is very high, but you also have constrained budgets, so supply is very low. And this, in the extreme example of the Soviet Union, you end up with grocery stores with empty shelves.
Hmm.
Well, if I get sick, I don't want to go to a hospital where there's a line out the door. And I need care now, and they say, we'll come back in 2 years. And this does happen.
Thanks very much for the call. Before we go to more phone calls, let me just talk about Rush Limbaugh for a moment, if you don't mind. There's been a lot, and I'm wondering if it was overblown here. A couple things. One is, do you think that the Democrats have made the storyline that Rush Limbaugh is the new head of the Republican Party? Number two, do we need to listen to him more carefully? And I guess number three is, did another strong voice emerge from the conference?
You know, Rush Limbaugh has been, I mean, he's an entertainer, first of all. He's a very successful talk show host. I think he's a pretty bright guy. I'm not an expert on what he's been saying lately, but for the Democrats, I think they're wrong to try to make Rush Limbaugh the head of the Republican Party, because first of all, he's not. He is an entertainer. He has a very popular following, but there's certainly similar characters all over the political spectrum. So I don't quite understand what they're going at there. They need to go after the leaders of the Republican Party and hold them accountable.
So people have made too much, because it's sort of an endless cycle here of his comments that he hopes the administration fails, and then you have all these talk shows about how can he hope for that to happen, what does he mean by that, et cetera, and people debate whether or not that was an incendiary comment or not. Are we making too much of all of that? Is a news cycle making too much of all of that?
I mean, personally, I think so. They're free to do that if they want, but I don't think Rush Limbaugh claims to speak for anyone but himself.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to
an opinion. Yeah,
right. Let's go to Tom from River Falls. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'd like to start off with a quote from America's premier capitalist and investor, billionaire Warren Buffett, who said, "There is a class war in America, and my class is winning. And it's shameful that his secretary pays more in taxes percentage-wise than he does." And I wanted to correct your guest's constant revisionist history about the New Deal and what happened during the Republican Great Depression. The New Deal rescued America from that disaster, and he inherited an economy with 25% unemployment thanks to the laissez-faire Hoover Coolidge policies, and brought it down to 14% before World War II. This constant revisionist history of how the New Deal did not produce results is just, you know, goes against the facts. And when they called Roosevelt a socialist / Marxist as well when he saved the economy. And regulated capitalism is not the same as Marxist socialism. I don't know why you guys think rules in the game of markets has to equate with communism or socialism or Marxism. And this is another fact before I go here. The decades of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, when we had top marginal tax rates of 90%, between 90 and 70%, is when we had the biggest growth in our economy. So how do you explain that?
Matt?
Well, I'll respond first to the Warren Buffett comment. And understand me, I think the fact of life in America or any economic system is that there is a small percentage of people that are really rich. And the thing about rich guys like Warren Buffett is they're going to be rich under any system. And I'm not really worried about those guys. I don't wake up in the morning worrying about whether or not Bill Gates is going to get 3 square meals that day. What I am worried about is are people that are trying to do better for themselves at the bottom of the economic ladder. And if you look at systems like France or Germany, old Europe economies, or certainly the Soviet Union, what you saw was there's still rich people and there's still poor people, but it's very difficult for poor people to get wealthy. And that's the difference between our economy and our free market philosophy than the rest of the world. And I think we always want to live in a world where a guy with a good idea but not a lot of money can go out and make something of himself or herself. Warren Buffett, if he's worried about the fact that he doesn't pay enough taxes, I always wondered why he didn't go ahead and just pay more. As for the history of the Great Depression, I don't have the data in front of me, but as I recall the data, the economy, he didn't inherit 25% unemployment. Because keep in mind that for all the mistakes Hoover made that hurt the economy, I think that the Depression really kicked in after that. And you're going to see the same dynamic today. Does that mean that FDR created 25% unemployment? Not necessarily, because he inherited a lot of policies, but he did not get us out of it. And that's the thing when you compare it to someone like like Harding. Harding took an old traditional tough love. We're going to cut government expenditures. We're going to cut taxes. We're going to cut regulation. And the economic pain was very short-lived. And we went from massive unemployment to economic growth. And it's, and how long these things last matters profoundly. And it's one thing to be out of a job for a year. It's another thing to be out of a job for 10 years. It's a world of difference.
How do you, let me just ask a simple question here. How do you deal with a rising unemployment rate, people losing their jobs or having to go to part-time work, large numbers of people on part-time work? How do you get those people back into the economy if you're doing, if you're lessening government expenditures, if you're not stimulating the economy by putting money into the economy?
Well, imagine, again, going back to most jobs are generated by small businesses, and you want to come up with policies that free up the small entrepreneur to create new jobs. And how do they create new jobs? You got to make capital available to them, and I think the best way to do that is to stop taxing capital. You want to make it so that the regulations that they have to, the hoops they have to run through the regulatory structure in order to start a new business are reasonable and relatively efficient. Otherwise, it's just another barrier to keeping them to do that. If you don't want to do that and you want to go the government spending route, again, the problem is you can certainly create construction jobs. Interestingly, I'll digress just a second. The Obama stimulus bill spent about $1 trillion. Only 5% of that was for infrastructure. And a good Keynesian, I believe, would argue that if you're going to do a jobs program, you want to build things that will create economic opportunities in the long run. And there wasn't a lot of that in there. Mm-hmm. So they're not necessarily creating the kind of jobs I think people envision when they think about a government jobs program. And even FDR, he created a lot of bricks and mortar construction jobs.
So you wouldn't be...
So it's different.
But would you be opposed to that philosophy of putting money in the ability to spend government money on infrastructure?
Well, the challenge with government, and this is why I think government is almost always inefficient, is the political process is a very clumsy way to decide which projects are most economically viable. And you see, you know, all the outrage about earmarks and the so-called bridge to nowhere in Alaska. These are politically driven decisions. They're not economically driven decisions. So you and I could certainly sit down as rational individuals and say, well, why didn't we build a 21st century energy grid?
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of project that in the abstract makes a lot of sense. But once you run it through the political process, you get all sorts of parochial interests that are, you know, clawing for a benefit at the table.
Thanks, Tom, very much for your call. Let's go to Rich from Rhinelander next. Hello, Rich.
Good morning.
Hi.
First, I want to say I appreciate your guest's tone. He sounds very moderate. His voice is calming. His pace is deliberate. But I think he'll probably agree with me on the following point, and it amounts to an argument of what's good for the goose is good for the gander. The sort of gain from so-called free trade that economists like so much is that which affects low and moderate income workers in the United States of America the most. That is, corporations have been told that globalization means that labor is just like any other commodity and that you should seek the lowest prices for that labor. Now, we're told that in the long run, this is going to be beneficial to the workers of the United States. So I'm going to agree with that, but I'm going to say that what's good for low and moderate income workers should be good for our lawyers, our doctors, our hospitals, our universities. And if low and moderate income workers are asked to compete against people who earn 50 cents an hour, that's actually a fairly high wage on the global market. It really is. then I really think professional. Professional services, there are plenty of smart kids in the developing world who can learn English probably better than some of our teenagers, who can be trained to our standards. They can become our lawyers, our doctors, our university professors. And I'd like to see your guest, and this is not meant out of meanness, I would like to see your guest paid a penny on a word for his academic writing.
Matt, it was an interesting call.
I think my wife agrees with you on that, by the way. What's interesting about the whole outsourcing debate is that two of the hottest sources of outsourcing in India, for instance, is legal work, because lawyers and billables per hour in India are much cheaper for the same quality work, but also high tech. And these are highly trained individuals that are capable of doing work cheaper than us. But I'll go back to labor economics 101, and this is what I think the American advantage is. There's two ways to be more productive as a worker. You can work harder, and there's obvious limits to that, or you can have better tools, and tools come from capital. The American advantage has always been that our workers are more efficient because we're able to give them better tools to work with, which, again, grows the pie. I don't think the American economy will ever succeed competing toe-to-toe with cheap foreign labor. Where we win that fight is when we have enough capital to make our workers more productive. And that's the great anecdote to outsourcing, is to freeing up entrepreneurs to make workers more efficient. And it's not a zero-sum game. You're creating more jobs. You're creating better-paying jobs. And it's good. It's literally a win-win situation for everybody when we allow that to happen.
Thank you, Rich, so much for your interesting call, as always. Bill from Orfordville is next. Hi, Bill.
Yes, good morning. Very interesting topic and very controversial, obviously. I'm a people first person. I don't think personal responsibility is an icon as iconic as it was when we were clearing the wilderness. We have 300 million people in this country alone, and the capitalistic system may have attributes, positive and negative, obviously, but it's come down pretty unfair. And it's creating a class warfare in this country, or at the initial stages of this class warfare, that's going to get more violent. I mean, we just see too many people being rewarded for just criminal-type activity, at least the perception of criminal-type activity. And we're not going to solve this crisis. The people that I deal with on an everyday level out here in the country, we're not happy because we don't see any of this being addressed, people who have gotten into this mess being penalized in any way, shape, or form. So why should we believe in anything else? You know, we're putting our money in the mattress. I mean, that's what's happening, and they have to come up with a new system that is more socially responsible. If you want to keep your capitalism, you got to make it fair, and it ain't right now.
All right, Bill, yeah. Thanks for the call. Matt?
You'll be shocked to know that I agree with you. And what we've seen, certainly in the last 18 months, but I think I've been seeing this trend for quite some time, is that, the so-called capitalist system, not a capitalist system, it's a government-distorted capitalist system that subsidizes certain corporations at the expense of others. I mean, look at the TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, last year proposed by Secretary Paulson and President Bush. We opposed that with every fiber in our bodies because it was rewarding irresponsibility of the most well-heeled investment bankers in the country. And they had bellied up to the government table to get a bailout, and we gave it to them. And now, after we give them hundreds of billions of dollars in taxpayer money, now we're outraged to learn how much they make. Well, I'm all for capitalists making a lot of money, but I think they need to be responsible. And in the case of of many of those actors, they needed to go out of business, and we didn't let them. And I don't think that that's the capitalist system. The capitalist system is all about individual responsibility, individual reward, but also accountability. If you lose money, you go out of business, and that to me is fair.
Well, we kept hearing during that debate, as you will recall, that we couldn't let them go out of business, that the ramifications for the entire financial system would have been too great.
Yeah. And, it, you know, to take the case of Citibank, we've bailed out Citibank maybe half a dozen times, my memory, and maybe longer. And they're a classic example of too big to fail. Well, any time that any industry is labeled as too big to fail, I think the taxpayers at best should only be put on the hook once. And if you're going to go in and bail out Citibank, we should also go in and dismantle it and create smaller institutions that, one, will compete with each other, but two, will not be too big to fail. So when they mess up, they can go out of business.
We take more phone calls from Matt in a moment. Matt Kibbe is our guest. He is president and CEO of Freedom Works. It recruits, educates, trains, and mobilizes hundreds of thousands of volunteer activists to fight for less government, lower taxes, and more freedom. He's been with the organization previously known as Citizens for a Sound Economy for the past 12 years and is an economist by training. Well, more phone calls. Our number is 8. We have one line open right now, 800-486-8655. We also have an email that you can use, and that's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Tuesday. Every year, a very small group of researchers ventures across the ice sheets of Antarctica in search of meteorites. And it's amazing what they find and what they tell us about space, what they tell us about the moon and other planets. We'll be talking with the principal investigator of the Antarctic search for meteorites about the 2008-09 exploration, what they've been able to learn about us as a result of exploring these, and how they go about finding them, too. It's a fascinating story. So that's coming up the second hour of our program. Back to phone calls for Matt. Our next caller is Joe from Wausau. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Hi. I have two comments. I first have some comments which lead to a second comment. And first is, America takes, for America to work, we need the benefits of both capitalism and socialism. Each system by themselves doesn't work, fairly for the country as a whole. Capitalism works great for innovation, but socialism, is required for necessities like roads, police departments, fire departments, and I really think health care as well. And it brings me to my second point in being, I've been trying to go into business myself for quite a while. I have a degree in computer engineering, and I'd like to build my own computer store and service the local population. But I can't do it mainly because there isn't health care provided for everybody. Health care isn't a right. You have to be wealthy or employed by a company to have health care, and this is not helping entrepreneurs or people who want to go into business start their own business, as well as there aren't enough regulations controlling corporations. For some reason, corporations are considered people, and actual people don't have any individual financial responsibility to manage the corporation properly. And corporations people have to start being responsible for the corporations that they run. And so capitalism is great, but the government needs to create rules and regulations that force capitalism to run properly so that greed and just plain, so pretty much greed doesn't control the country, and a sense of fairness and patriotism controls the country instead.
And all right, Joe.
Comments off the air.
Okay, thanks, Joe, for the call. Matt?
You know, the healthcare point is interesting, and I think I'd come to the same conclusion, but from a different perspective. Under the third-party payment system that we have right now, where most people get their health insurance either from their employer or through Medicare and Medicaid, it has essentially destroyed the individual market for health insurance. So it's very difficult for an individual, if he doesn't work for a corporation or doesn't get Medicare or Medicaid, to buy insurance. And since there is no market for it, the cost of doing that is extraordinary. And to me, it's a broken system, and it needs to be changed. But what I'd like to see is a very robust personal market where all individuals could go buy the kind of health insurance they needed. For instance, right now, when a young person gets a job with Corporation X, they pretty much get a defined benefit package. But typically what a young person needs from health insurance is a catastrophic plan in case he or she gets in real trouble. Because young people are healthier and they really don't necessarily need the Cadillac plan that someone at the age of 50, 60 needs. So I agree with that, but the answer is not to socialize the system. The answer is to get these third parties, which again, this is a government regulated system that has created a third party system. Get that out of there so that people can get individualized care, individualized choices. That's the way to go.
And thanks very much for your call. Let's go next to Mike from Milwaukee. Hello, Mike.
Hi.
Hi. Well,
speaking of third-party systems, I'm so disillusioned with the two parties that we have that I am definitely considering voting Libertarian next time around. I feel that the Republicans have let me down, and I think that they basically are socialists. They're socialists, corporate socialists, through lobbying. And please comment.
I think, and from my perspective as well, we've done nothing but criticize Republicans for quite some time. And you know, there's a reason that the founders set up a two-party system, because they wanted to force a resolution on these issues. And you certainly get, for all the talk about gridlock, you get answers to these questions whether or not you agree with them. But I think going back to the first question of this talk show, Republicans need to get their voice back. And I think historically you look at their political successes, whether it be Reagan in 1980 or the Republican contract in 1994, they connect with people when they stand for limited government, smaller government, and individual responsibility. And when they don't do that, they fail. And you see that right now. The Democrats stand for something else, and they certainly succeeded at the polls this last November.
And so the Republicans need to go which direction? Who is the spokesperson for this? And do they have a coherent plan? I guess we're back to where we started here.
Yeah. Well, they certainly have some of the rising stars that we're very enthusiastic about includes your own Congressman Paul Ryan, who's a bright, young, energetic congressman from the trying to think of his hometown, but it's
Janesville.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
He's the kind of Republican that I would like to see. He's not a big business Republican. He believes in opportunity, and he really thinks that less government creates jobs and opportunity for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a couple governors that I'm pretty excited about, including the governor of South Carolina, Mark Sanford, who incidentally has spent his entire governorship fighting with his own Republican legislature because they're spending too much money on garbage that the state can't afford. But the message that Republicans will win under is not corporate capitalism, but it's the kind of freedom that allows people to achieve and to pursue better opportunities. It's what I call pocketbook conservatism. They shouldn't spend money they don't have. We shouldn't, in times of economic crisis, the last thing you want to do is ask the taxpayers to pay more, even if they're rich. But, you know, remember the first thing Obama did when he expanded the SCHIP program was he raised cigarette taxes. I don't smoke. I never have, but tobacco taxes are very regressive. So the first thing he did is he raised taxes on people that could least afford to do that. This is not the Republican agenda. They don't want to raise taxes on anyone, again, when they're successful. And they should think twice about pork barrel projects, and they should set priorities within a limited budget.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to phone calls. Thanks very much for the call. Tom from Racine is next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I can't believe what I'm hearing. The guest talks about government inefficiencies, inability to do things. Would he advocate the complete elimination of the public education system in this country? In other words, why should we provide public education? Why not let people pay for it individually? And that leads me to my second comment. How does he explain the paradox of the socialized medical system of Western Europe that costs $3,500 per person in comparison to our $7,000 per person system in the United States? In Europe, they cover everybody at $3,500 per person. In this country, spends $7,000 per person.
All right, let's get a response. Matt?
I'll answer the healthcare question first. I think the difference between the socialized systems of Europe and our system is extremely expensive, but you're also not comparing apples to apples. For all the inefficiencies in the American healthcare system, if someone needs an MRI, they get it. In Europe, they don't. And it's a question of how much you're willing to spend and what sort of technologies and treatments you want available to you. But again, as I've said, the government, the American system is not functioning properly. We spend way too much on healthcare, but it's also still the best quality system in the world. And under a socialized system, you ration things. You have a budget, and typically the budget is not big enough for what needs to be done, and that just means that people wait in line for the treatments they need. Now, on education...
Before you go back, you didn't mean to say, did you, that you don't get the MRI if you need it, you have to wait in line for it. Is that what you're saying? Or are you saying that you're not getting the MRI?
In a socialized system, you very often don't get the MRI you need because it's either the machine's not available, where there's such a long line to use the machine, you simply don't get it. It's a ration system.
Okay. Carry on. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. And it's interesting you bring up both education and healthcare. If you look at historically the two most inflationary sectors of the American economy have been education, both K-12 and higher education, and healthcare. And these are both heavily and sometimes exclusively government subsidized systems. At least in the case of healthcare, you can say that, that the spending, as exorbitant as it is and how outrageous the prices are, you're at least getting quality. I would argue that the American education system is broken. And for all the money I live in the District of Columbia, and for all the money we spend to educate our kids, the D.C. school system produces horrible results. And I, for one, think that parents should get a choice as to whether or not they send their children to the local public school or maybe some other option if in fact, they're not happy with the results they're getting.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Tom, very much for your call. And we go next to Larry from Madison. We're running short on time, everybody. Hi, Larry. We have about a minute.
Thank you. I take issue with the guests talking about Social Security as being wildly underfunded. Seems to me he may have given the impression that Social Security is in danger of imminent collapse. But let's take note of the fact that today the system takes in more every month than it pays out, and this will continue until, in the worst case, 2041, or in the best case, till 2051, according to the Congressional Budget Office. But with some small changes, such as modestly increasing the amount of earnings subject to Social Security tax, it will continue indefinitely, easily over the next 75 years, continuing to take in as much money as it pays out now.
Okay, we have about 10 seconds for a response, Matt. I'm sorry.
Well, it's a pension system, and you judge pension systems over a lifetime, not over the next couple of years. And the fact is that over time, there'll be a whole lot more people taking out of the system than are putting in, which will lead to its bankruptcy. And we can quibble as to whether or not that's going to happen 10, 20, 50 years from now. But either way, it's unsustainable.
Matt, thank you so much for being with us. Please join us again. Enjoy the hour. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Matt Kibbe is president and CEO of Freedom Works and was one of the keynote speakers at the weekend's conservative conference in Washington, the Conservative Political Action Conference. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios for all of your calls. I wish we could have taken more. Thanks. News is coming up. We'll return here on the Ideas Network.